Welcome to Mission 150, the podcast that tells stories from 150 years of Seventh-day Adventist mission to the world.
To find out more about the mission of the Adventist Church, go to AdventistMission.org. That's AdventistMission.org.
We're so glad that you've joined us again on Mission 150 with me, David Trim.
And me, Sam Nevis.
And a big thank you to those of our viewers and listeners who have got in touch to let us know you're enjoying and being blessed by this podcast. A special shout out to the Danish listener living in Norway who listens to the podcast while skiing. That has to be the coolest way to engage with Mission 150.
I didn't know that. That's excellent.
I just heard that feedback in the last week.
I had a feedback from Egypt. There's a missionary in Egypt.
Yes.
Who was very moved when she heard the story of Keo in those two episodes.
Right, right.
So, and we keep hearing stories all the time.
Not skiing, I assume.
Not in Egypt.
Not skiing in Egypt. Different sports there.
That's quite fantastic that they're doing. Are they like, did they specify, is it downhill or is it cross country skiing?
Seeing it's in Norway in winter, it's probably just cross country.
Yeah, but that is, yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Let me introduce you first, Kyle.
Yes, that's
guys,
probably a good
Kyle.
Idea.
Kyle is the director of The Hopeful, film that's coming out in cinemas in the United States within, you know, in
4 weeks, April 17th. Yes.
As we record this, it's March, but it will be coming out just before. So for listeners, it will be coming out in the next couple of days.
Yes.
Kyle, 2024 is the 150th anniversary of the departure of John N. Andrews and his two children. Charles and Mary were their names. Mm. They all went to Europe together, the first missionaries sent by the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Your film starts with Andrews and his two children, but The Hopeful isn't really about them. What part do they play in the film?
Well, I think, I mean, The Hopeful is about them in the sense that that story, so if you've ever seen a film called The Princess Bride, so The Hopeful structurally functions a bit like that, right? So it's a story told by Andrews to his kids, and then you go back into that story, and then it weaves that tale up until the payoff at the end of it, which I won't ruin because then it'd be a spoiler alert. But you know, I guess the role that they play in this story is at those moments where, as an audience, we go, "Ooh, I wonder what that's about, or why this." They're able to pop in and go, "Well, that's very confusing, isn't it?" Because there are some aspects of history that are very confusing that need, particularly in a storytelling setting like cinema, for an audience to get the permission to be able to question, you know? And I think that that's really critical. Like if you don't feel like you can go, "Oh, I wonder why that," then that engagement and that reflection and the way that you kind of, you grapple with the issues that the characters are grappling with, I think it's a really great way to get in really quickly. So Andrews and his kids are a fascinating and fabulous way to do that for an audience really quickly to be like, "Oh, okay, I'm with this story because I'm with this family on their journey to somewhere, which I don't know where at the moment, at the beginning of the film."
And I suppose the film is how they got there.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So you've been telling stories for many years.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about your path in creating films as a filmmaker and then as a director.
Yeah, well, I mean, I never meant to do this. Like, it wasn't a purposeful thing where, you know how sometimes people have those origin stories of their storyteller, where they're like, you know, I was like splicing together at the age of five, 8mm film. That was not me, right? Like, it was not something that, you know, the interesting thing about growing up Adventist is that was not a pathway that was actively spoken about or encouraged or talked about. So it's fascinating to me when I got that sense was really out of looking around at something else to do, because teaching in inner city London comprehensive schools when I first moved to London in 2005 is really difficult. Mm. And I'm not built for crowd control, as you can tell. Like, I'm more of an artistic soul than a crowd control. So in looking at that, I'd done some amateur theatre and church productions. And I went naively, "Oh, I could probably act, right? And the reality is that you look at the different schools that you could think about going to.
Right.
My wife, very wisely, I'd only been married for a year at the time, went, well, if it's not selective, how do we know if you're any good? So there's only like three really top selective theatre training schools in the UK.
That's right.
So I looked at them and I went for one particularly, a place called Drama Centre, and got in, miraculously. It's very heavily, you know, three auditions, it's very competitive.
Turns out you were good.
Turns out I was all right. But what that did is that you suddenly get in there and you realise, oh, okay, so all this mystery of storytelling actually isn't mysterious anymore, because you've got all these really top practitioners in their craft, and they come in and they work with you and they open your mind to how to use yourself to tell a story. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, through another couple of series, so I meant to be an actor and then accidentally went behind the camera and was like, ooh, I like this even more, because you've got that bigger picture, right? So you can work then with actors to craft this bigger story and really focus on what this journey is for the audience that we're going to take them on, right? So whether that's a 5-minute short film piece, or whether it's a documentary, long form, short form, or whether it's narrative feature work, that journey that you take your audience on is really critical, right? And if you're not thinking about that from the moment you start developing it, it's going to be haphazard and not necessarily specific, that journey that they go on. So it's almost like, think of it like a ride when you go to Universal Studios or to Disney World. You get on that ride and there's a very clear beginning, middle and end to that. And at the end of it, you sit back and you're like, whoa, well, that was pretty great.
Hopefully
it's not just you meandering through some stuff and you're like, why did I do that? Mm-hmm. So I think storytelling, and particularly cinema, what that training taught me was that you have to be very deliberate about how you're crafting that experience for people, because it is like a ride, right? Like, and we want to be satisfied at the end of it that we got what we paid for. Mm-hmm. You know, that we got a great story, that we got to feel emotions that aren't necessarily safe in our normal life, but they are safe in cinema, or they are safe when I'm engaging with them on television, right? And they provoke me and prompt me to think about how I would respond in that situation.
We're going to come back to this, but let's go back to your homeland.
Yes.
You mentioned London, but yes, you're not from England.
No.
You are Australian.
No. I am, indeed. So the accent probably slightly gives that away.
I understand you went back to Australia afterwards.
Yes.
But tell us about growing up too. You said you grew up back in this. Tell us where you grew up and tell us a little bit about your let's just go backwards a little bit.
So a little tiny town in Victoria in Australia called Warburton, which at the time when I was growing up there, Warburton had a very big Adventist presence. Like, it was basically, the whole town was Adventist. So there was a hospital there. There was Sanitarium Health Food, which makes Weet-Bix for those of you that are in Australia, New Zealand. And also there was Science Publishing Company, where my father worked, which did basically all of the publication printing for the South Pacific Division. So this was, I mean, it was huge. The church had like 1,000 people at it on the weekend. It was a big, you know, growing up there was very vibrant. There was a lot of activities going on, you know, like the, and again, we were just talking about this guy skiing. Like, I learned to cross country ski. There was a mountain that we actually lived at the base of, where it had enough snow at winter that I remember when I was, I think maybe 13, I bought a pair of secondhand cross country skis.
You can ski in Australia?
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean,
not a lot.
And getting less.
6 miles.
Yes.
That's, no, not quite.
But there was a road that went from the top of that mountain to a little town called Healesville over the other side. And certain sections of it at certain times in winter would get enough snow that I would get, like, my sister, when she got a driver's license, to drop me off at the gate at the front, at one side of it, and then I would ski and get picked up on the other side of it from time to time. With, like, I think it was a $25 pair of skis or something that I bought from the charity shop. It was great, and it was a really great place to grow up from a community sense and feel. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. it's interesting now when you get back to that town, basically all of those Adventist industries don't exist there anymore.
Really?
Yeah. What happened? The hospital shut down there because they're too far out of like a central area. So I think back in, it was in the 90s. The signs, interestingly, is still going.
The publishing
company. Yeah. So like in 2024, for a particularly a religious publisher to still be printing and actually have press machines and be still going, when even a lot of the mainstream publishers shut down in Australia.
But
it's,
as a media,
pretty cool.
As a media company, they serve the people that live outside of that community.
Yes, correct.
The hospital would serve people that are right there. And if there aren't that many people, you can't stay alive for long.
Well, interestingly now, if they'd stayed open past that point now, they would have had a huge community to service. So it's really fascinating when you look at the way that that goes sometimes, right? At a certain point, at that stage when it did shut down, there wasn't a community to serve. Now there is again. And you're kind of like, what a shame it doesn't exist. But it's certainly growing up, I think what that showed me, even in a small country town in Australia, was that we are part of something bigger. You always got that sense, I remember as a kid, like that this, you know, we would go to like picnics and stuff with the signs and the sanitarium and the hospital, and they were massive. You know, it was a couple of thousand people would be at this thing. And you, so you always got that sense that there was something more outside of that little niche that you were a part of. Like it felt big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Australians sent a lot of missionaries, didn't they? There were a lot
Yes.
Australian missionaries absolutely across the Pacific.
Yep. Yeah, all around the South Pacific and also to Southern and Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
Oh, we were talking earlier, David, you've got only 80,000 Adventists in Australia or so, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
Do you remember the latest statistics?
I don't remember the latest statistics. It may not even be that many.
Yeah. So you have less than 100,000, let's say, Australian Seventh-day Adventists. But they have a profound influence in the church globally and have for many years.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is, it must be something there. Well.
Yeah, I mean, Australians are, you know, what's the old cliche, has passport, will travel. Is kind of the
Australian. Yeah,
will travel is kind of the Australian mantra. And also, you know, because it's so far from everywhere else in the grand scheme of things, like if you feel compelled to go outside of Australia, you're going to have to go because anywhere is a distance away, you know. Maybe not Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea is strangely close, but to get to that closeness, you're up on the very tip of Australia where there's nothing.
So you've come from the south or anywhere, Perth, for example.
Then it's
a proper journey.
Yeah, it's an 8-hour plane flight from Perth to Port Moresby.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, people that were inclined to do that back in, particularly in like the 50s, 60s, 70s, I mean, you really did it. It was probably like several plane hops across the country.
Right.
You know, in any of those island directions, if you go into the Solomons or, you know, my in-laws spent almost 17 years as missionaries out in between Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands and Fiji. You know, and that's not out of the norm for their generation.
Yes.
Like when you talk to their friends and contemporaries who are all retired now, but they all have this huge draw and affinity to mission work in the islands, even though that's shifted now. So very few Australians go over there to live and work in that sense because they did such a good job there that it's all handed over to people that live there now.
That's right.
Sure. Yeah,
that's right.
Which is how it should be. But, you know, that era of getting out and actually doing something positive outside of your little sphere of influence, I think, I mean, it's very culturally Adventist, right? But it seemed to be particularly part of that culture in that 60s, 70s, 80s kind of era, yeah.
Kyle, you've been involved in quite a lot of film and television work. What has most stood out? And also, please tell us about your involvement in Beyond the Search.
Yeah. I think what stood out the most is that when you tell stories with a group of people, that immediate group, so your cast and your crew, are the most engaged in that story from the get-go. So that relationship that you form with them, and I've been really fortunate because I've worked predominantly, so when I've made and told stories that have a faith base or for the church, it's always been with people who aren't Adventist.
Mm.
You know, so for the most part, it's been me telling either a faith story or a faith adjacent story or an Adventist story straight up, working with people who have either very limited or no understanding of that cultural context or anything. So, I mean, that to me is fabulous because it broadens your horizon on how to tell that Adventist story or that faith story, because they will ask you questions that you would never have thought of.
Your target audience is right in front of you.
Yeah.
So you cannot put them aside and forget about them because they're helping you tell that story.
Correct.
So they need to fall in love with it.
Yes.
And the chances that other people will, just like them, increases exponentially. It's a
pretty interesting way
of going about telling stories.
It reframes for you. Sometimes I think that, particularly if you've been lifelong any religion, right, or lifelong Adventist particularly, there's a way that we speak that doesn't necessarily always translate to people that don't speak that language, right? So you have to, you get challenged regularly when you're out, you know, beyond the perfect example of this. So we had three presenters.
I don't know much about it. What was it?
Yeah, so it was a 14-part series,
The Search.
The Search, yeah. So South Pacific Division had a vision to do. There had been a series called Beyond, which was like a 25-part DVD series back in the day that they did direct mailer. So it was all about like big questions that are raised out of the worldview that is Adventism.
Okay.
And that had gone really well for them in the 90s, and then in the, you know, 2010 kind of era, they wanted to do that again. And that's what I got bought in for, because somebody at the SPD had been become aware of what I was doing in Europe.
SPD, South Pacific
Division. And so they had talked to me about, so what would your take be on this? And I said, well, let's have a look at it. Like, how would we do this in an engaging way that's almost like travel documentary style?
Hmm.
But it isn't just one older evangelist. Like, why don't we get a spread of, you know, because you cannot like one person.
Yes.
Right? Yep. But it's really difficult in a series if there's three people to engage with to not be like, well, I don't like them or them, but actually I quite warm to that person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So because of that, I'll watch the episode just to see them pop up, right? So it's a really good, like, rule of three is quite a good rule in storytelling. It's why we have beginning, middle, and end, and, you know, act one, act two, act three. It's why they work. And so what we constructed was we had a Danielle, Johnny, and Jeff. So Jeff is like the older evangelist, like the stable type. Johnny was kind of like the loose cannon, like action, go out and do, you know, riding bulls, which he did
in
the series. Yeah, which I would never recommend to get your presenters to ride bulls, even if they've ridden them before. It's hugely concerning when you have to get them to do one more take. And you go, we just managed to not kill you that first time round. Maybe we shouldn't do this again, but we did. So there you go. And it looks great because, you know, crazily in my head, I was like, so you're going to ride this bull out of a gate, fall off, and then pop up and walk over to the fence and deliver your line to camera? Because, of course, what could possibly go wrong?
Adrenaline pumping.
What could possibly go wrong in that?
Yeah.
Turns out lots of things. But anyway, we ended up getting a really, like, when you see that in that episode, it is great, right? Because it's alive with action and anticipation.
I need to watch that. I haven't seen any of it.
So they're really engaging episodes, and they look at things.
So it's looking at, you're about to say.
Yeah, looking at big issues like, death. What are all the different ways that we can look at death? And then what's a way that Adventists in our worldview look at that and frame it? What do you think? So it's very much, there's this, and there's also this Adventist way of looking at it. What's your thoughts on that? So it's a very open, almost travel documentary discussion style that makes it really easy to engage with. And we're like running all over the world. We're like looking at Dracula in castles in like
Romania,
which is Sighișoara, which was fantastic. And again, you're having these incredible experiences with people who are just, you know, one day they're on a documentary shoot for Discovery Channel and the next day they're running sound on your show. You know, and asking all these fabulous questions about, so who are you guys again? And like, why are we doing this? because it's so out of the normal, you know, like we're driving around Romania with this, it's a car called a Dacia, which is not a great vehicle, that's got a coffin strapped to the top of it as part of the storyline, right? Because that's the whole thing. And at one point we've got, yeah, it's just, it was mad fun. And we had, when we were developing it, we had an ad guy from Sydney who had done some really massive ad campaigns for Channel 10 and Channel 7 over there. And we would pitch him ideas. And he was great because every now and again, he'd be like, whoa, guys, just stop for a second. Okay, so you just told me this thing. Mm-hmm. And you brushed over it like it was no big deal. But I've literally never heard anyone articulate whatever it is, like rest and how that rhythm of like a 24-hour cycle works, right? So that's fascinating to me. Tell me more about that.
We have our bubbles.
Yes.
And it is very difficult for you to realize how precious it is, the things you have, until you realize people don't.
Yes.
And that interaction is brilliant. Okay, let's go back to the hopeful, your current project.
Yeah.
So we've been talking about missionaries for a very long time. And we've been sending people on missions for a very long time. And we've conquered, let's say conquered in the sense that we've conquered our fears in going into new territories and lack of resources and all sorts in order for the mission or the proclamation of the gospel to go to different geographies. We mentioned the Australians going everywhere. Yeah. But then there is another way of looking at this expansion of mission, and that is the use of the media across the years. So we've started with print, and then we used radio, and then came the era of the screens.
Yeah.
So you have the television screens, and then you have, you know, projector screens, and then you had, you know, mobile phone screens.
Yeah.
And what I find fascinating is we have proclaimed the gospel on television for a long time.
Mm.
We have proclaimed the gospel, the everlasting gospel on presentation, using projectors and screens in that sense. And we have done it with mobile phones too.
Mm.
But we had never conquered the largest screen of them all, which is the cinema. As it turns out, it's the original screen. Cinema started before all of this.
Yeah.
How do you feel having, as an Adventist, having the story of this movement told in hundreds and hundreds of cinema screens in the United States?
Well, let me ask you this question. If something is of value to you, right, and it is the defining story of why you do the things that you do, why would you not want that told at the highest possible quality level that you can do it at? You know, and this was, I guess, this was the driving force for me behind why cinema and why this, our story of why we exist and for what purpose. You know, I'm 46 this year and I've only been for the last 2 years. Like if you'd known me prior to 2 years ago when I started doing posts on this, you would probably not know I was Adventist because I wouldn't be telling you. I certainly wouldn't be sitting here talking about it openly and comfortably and easily. And I think that that's a real problem that we have in Adventism. Mm. Like we have we've cultivated a really unhealthy sense of shame, right? Almost we've told ourselves that people aren't going to be receptive to us, so we better not let them know that this is who we are and what we, you know. And it's really odd to me now, 2 years down the track, having gone through this, what I set out to do really was tell our story because it's my story, right? So I went, well, it's my story. I don't want to sit next to people who aren't part of that story currently that I know that I'm good friends with and feel in any way, shape or form embarrassed about it. Like I want to sit in a cinema and I want to feel like at the end of it, they're like, wow, that was a great story. You know, what a fantastic, and it's provoked me. And now I'm challenged by the way I would respond in moments of disappointment and how I could persevere. And would I be a person that like held strong to the things that are important to me? or would I be someone that at the first obstacle went, it's too hard, I'm going to move on, right? Because those aren't unique to Adventism or Christianity.
Yeah.
Those are, you know, if you look at anticipation and when that anticipation turns into disappointment, the perseverance you have to do to hold on to
that's
the
human.
Thing.
It's human. It's not particularly Advent. So it connects
human.
With everyone.
Yes.
So you're talking about this shame, the grasshopper principle. We look yeah. like grasshoppers in their eyes without ever talking to them.
Yeah. yes, because it may not even be the case, right?
Yes. So the 12 spies never talked yeah. to anybody there. So how would they know?
Yes.
The first spies that actually talked to the people were the spies that Joshua yeah. sent and talked to mm-hmm. Rahab.
And they get an immediate result.
Completely
yeah.
different narrative to what they expected.
But I think that that result, that's part of the problem that we have as Adventists, right? Like we look at that result in terms of like, what are the numbers that we got? How many people got baptized as a result of this? What's the data on it? And actually, I think if we stepped back and we went, well, what's the unique character of Christ message that every single person that listened to Miller actually locked into, right? So William Miller, the Millerite movement prior to 1844, there are no Adventists, right? Like these are all just people who start listening to this guy who found this character of Christ that was almost in complete opposition to what you would hear in every other church of the day, which was God's judgment and his wrath. Or wrath, depending on how you want to say that and where you're from. So one of the first people that locks into this in a significant way in the Adventist context is Ellen. So Ellen listens to Miller for the first time in a church where he's talking about the character of Christ as hopeful and healer. And this sticks with her for her entire life, right? Because what she hears there is in complete opposition to everything else she's ever been told. So I've heard of his wrath and his judgment, or his wrath and his judgment, but his healing, I've never, ever heard anyone talk about his healing before. And that, she says, is beautiful. And it is. And that is literally the single most important thing that we have to contribute to the conversation in Protestant Christianity today. Because if you look at the situation we are at in 2024, what you hear a lot is, you live like this, and you live like that, and you shouldn't do that because if you do, bam, God's wrath and judgment,
rah.
Right? And that is not the character of Christ that got Adventists excited about Christ's soon return in the first place.
From the outset.
From the outset, yeah.
Kyle, you refer to Ellen White there as Ellen, so I think, you know, that probably comes from having spent quite a lot of time.
Yes.
As it were, in the company of Adventist pioneers, because you're yeah. telling the story about them, did you yeah. begin to feel a sense of personal connection with
yes.
them? Yes,
100%. Because when these people cease to be on a pedestal or over there, and you can even see it in the way we've all just re-engaged with each other, right? Like everybody just moved forward then, because there's something interesting that happens with an energy of connection, you know? Like, and when you connect with these people and you realize that, okay, so they had extraordinary things happen to them. But despite of that, they still argued with their husbands and wives. They still didn't get family and work-life balance right.
They still struggled. They still mourned. They still, yeah.
Yes, and mourning is a big part of the film, actually.
100%, because, I mean, that's part of that cycle of anticipation and disappointment and perseverance, right? Yeah. So if you've locked into this, wow, I've seen a picture of Christ that is so different and so wholly inspiring in a way that I've never appreciated it before, and then something happens to distract you from that, it is really difficult to stay locked into that really simple thing that you've been tasked with.
Hence the first vision. Keep your eyes on, if you keep your yes. eyes on Jesus, you'll make it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, this juxtaposition between the fire and brimstone sermons
yes.
that you would expect in general evangelical
yeah.
churches at the time, or the traditional churches at least, and this eager anticipation for the second coming mm-hmm. that Miller was talking about,
yeah.
this personal relationship with Jesus, looking forward to the second coming, which
yeah.
was very odd.
Yes.
People did not preach about the second coming very often.
Yeah.
Although the Millerite movement grew and then they mm. begun, which is very different from today.
Yeah.
Today we have, in some sense, many Christian churches that do talk about the character of Christ and the love of Jesus, and the music has reflected that in the new hymns that are being written and so on. But that was rather different back then.
I would dare say that it's not too dissimilar right now in this moment where we sit in 2024, actually. You know, and I think you would find that we are not immune to it either. Like, there is a tendency to look at the usefulness of fear as a way to engage with people. And I think that what looking at the struggles that these early members of the church actually went through, what you realize is that the thing that kept them focused and on track was actually, so when I look at 1844, I don't see a problem. What I see is them discovering that their understanding of what that moment was and what it actually became for them were two different things, right? They had an expectation that that hope and healing was going to arrive on their doorstep and get them out of Dodge, right? That was their expectation, which is exactly the same as the expectation that first century Christians had, right? Christ is going to come and he's going to get us out of Dodge. This problem that we're in with the Romans is going to be solved. Right. Mm-hmm. So you look at what the understanding is that they arrived at by the time you get to formalization of we're Adventists and we think this is roughly what we're going to form into. That realization is actually what this is that we've got a task ahead of us now, which is to share that hope and healing that we've discovered with the community around us, and even further than that, with the world at large. And that is why today, you look at what Adventists are known for, if anyone even knows us, right? What are we known for? We're known for hospitals. We're known for Adventist Development and Relief Agency, humanitarian and aid work, and education. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the outworking of 50 years of going out and
160
years of going out and talking to the world about that unique character of Christ, and you look at what it's led to. I found out yesterday talking to somebody that it's the Adventism runs the largest Protestant healthcare network on the planet.
That's right.
Why did I not know that? You know, and that goes back to I think, you know, really what to me the hopeful, it's two things. For Adventists, it's about realizing that we have an identity in the first place, right? And that that identity is actually something that's very, very positive. And that identity is hope and healing. Like, what a great thing to be going out to the world with in 2024 when you look around at the almost the opposite of that message today. Like, to be able to go out with hope and healing, an amazingly positive thing to take out into your community. And for people that have never, ever even engaged or heard of what or who an Adventist is, re-identifying ourselves as people who struggle and doubt and persevere and yet still are able to lock on to that hope and healing, I think is a wonderful thing for a community to identify you as. Oh, you guys are the hopeful ones.
In the Adventist hospital system, there is a good number, I don't know what the ratio is, but there is a very large number of workers that are not Adventist.
Yeah.
And they're good doctors, they're great nurses.
Oh, amazingly so. And right. They don't, yes.
But they don't know the history very well.
Yeah, of where they work and why that's important.
Yes.
How would you encourage hospitals? Because we only have, in cinemas, we only have two showings, right, at the moment.
At the moment, unless we get out and support it as Adventists first.
I don't know if you knew this, David. Yeah. We have two showings, 17th and 18th.
And April. That's right. That's April 17th, April 17 and April 18th for those listening and viewing.
But if we have people, over half of those cinemas are filled, they will continue with more showings and for longer.
Well, it's pure economics.
I have no idea about that.
It's pure economics, right? So if people go and watch that film,
they will extend that film and take out other films that have gone.
Correct.
And then there's the chance of non-Adventists being what coming well, and watching
correct.
It and seeing it.
Yeah, the longer you're able to keep your story and that discussion of who you are and why you exist in that discussion forum of cinema, because cinema is the modern agora, right? It's like it's where we go afterwards into the lobby.
I'll tell you why.
Talk about big world issues.
I'll tell you why I'm mostly excited about this.
Yeah, just
cinema.
Mostly?
No, this is the most excited thing about this whole process.
Yes.
We are constantly distracted and our attention span is 3 seconds.
Oh,
the cinema is the last screen that you go in, you put your phone down and you engage with the story in a way that might mark your life forever thereafter.
Correct.
And as you said, if your story is worth telling, would you not want to expose people to the most beautiful version of it in the best environment possible?
Yeah.
How would you encourage pastors and maybe even schools and hospitals and so on to book group bookings so that we can fill these cinemas?
Well, do it now. Don't wait until the day before the film comes out, because that'll be too late, because exhibition will have already moved on and put other films on because they've seen the heat behind those.
So the sooner people
do it,
book,
so
the better.
If you're watching this now, go out and book it right now.
What's the website again?
Go to thehopefulmovie.com and literally the first button on there is buy a ticket. The second button directly underneath that is request a booking in your area.
So let's say that again, thehopefulmovie.com.
Yeah. And you can go in there and you can either buy individual tickets. I would encourage you actually to not just buy a single ticket for yourself, but the value and the power, and this is going to sound weird from the guy who made the movie, but the opportunity is not the film. The opportunity is individual Adventists being able to credibly and feel actually proud to take people that they know in their sphere of influence to engage with a story about them. It's their story. It's our story. And to be able to share that with their friends that they may have friend-zoned their faith with. So you've known someone for 5, 10 years, and at the beginning of when you met them, you had an opportunity to talk briefly or in depth about why you went to church on Saturday, for instance, and why you do certain things on the weekend a different way slightly to everybody else. And then you miss that opportunity, right? And then it becomes increasingly awkward over the years to have any sort of discussion
about
it, right?
But come and watch a movie.
But come and watch a movie together on Wednesday or Thursday night, the 17th or 18th of April, and you are going to go out to dinner together afterwards, and they are going to ask you all sorts of questions like, wow, I never knew this about that thing that you do.
So it's the greatest conversation starter.
And that's the thing, like you go and
see. That's what we want.
That's what you want. I mean, you go and see a movie like Oppenheimer, for instance, right? You walk out of Oppenheimer and you sit down afterwards with the people
that
you went to.
It's impossible not to talk about it.
And you have this discussion about, okay, so if I knew that there was even a 0.001% chance that if we push that button, the entire world's going to explode, would I push that button?
Yeah.
Probably not. So what is different about those guys to me? And that's challenging, right? That's provoking. And in our context, when you look at it and you go, okay, so I got all excited about Christ returning and then he didn't, right? Am I going to be the ones who wrestled and struggled and strived with that and stuck with the character of Christ?
Or the ones who give up?
Or am I going to be the ones who give up? And you know what I'm always challenged by, Sam and David, is that I'm suspicious I would have been the ones that gave up.
Yeah.
Right? I think we're always rose-colored glassed.
Yes. Yep. We would always be the hero in this story.
Yeah.
But talking about...
I like the fact that I may not be. I like the provocation and what that forces me to reflect on, right? Like, say, ooh, what if I'm the guy in Saving Private Ryan at the beginning of the movie, directly in front of Tom Hanks, right? So as the landing craft is going to Omaha Beach and the front drops down, I get hit in the head and my war's over in a split second and I'm done, right? Versus you're the main character of this story going through all the trials and tribulations to get to the moment at the end where you get the message to Ryan. Right? That's fascinating to me. Like, I love wrestling with those things when I go to movies, and I love thinking about, am I the bad guy in this story or am I the good person?
Yeah.
Or is there no good and bad person? There's just choices that you're given the opportunity to make. And sometimes in some contexts, I make good ones and sometimes I make bad ones.
Kyle Portbury, Emmy Award-winning director of The Hopeful.
Sounds so impressive, doesn't it, when you
truthful
put it like that?
Nonetheless.
So, yes.
Thank you for joining
us. Thank you, mate.
Yes. Thank you, David. Thank you so much for being with us, Kyle.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you so much for joining us again on Mission 150, which tells the story of the 150 years of Adventist mission to the world.
Please keep watching on the Seventh-day Adventist Church's YouTube channel, on AdventistReview.tv, or listening on your favorite podcast platform.
To know more about Adventist mission work today, go to AdventistMission.org. That's AdventistMission.org.
And if you're the kind of person who wants to serve today, go to VividFaith.com.
And if you want to know more about the movie, again, go to TheHopefulMovie.com. Join us each episode to learn, to be challenged, and to be inspired to become part of the mission of the Seventh-day Adventist Church.